sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
I need to get more prospects.
Right.
Because even if they don't have enough, when they find it and they can teach them to understand that's how they should be addressing and helping the customer, then they get that motivation to go out and get more prospects because, wow, I get this.
Yeah. Sometimes I think people don't truly understand the value of what they're really offering. Do you know what I mean? They don't understand the impact, the ripple effect of what their product or service can do for a company. For example, I sell sales training, right? That's one of my products. And so I believe when I sell it, I'm not looking at selling the package. I'm looking at how it's going to impact your bottom line, how it's going to increase your revenue, reduce your costs, or expand your market share. I'm looking at how I'm helping you not only stay in business, but keep people employed within your company. And those people in your company have families. So guess what? The fact that I'm helping you help your company, helps families, that's the way I view the value of it.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. That was Victor Antonio. He's a top-rated speaker and best-selling author of multiple sales books, including Sales Influence. And he's joining me on this episode of Sales Enablement, episode 762, to talk about how to elevate individual and team sales performance. We start our conversation with this provocative quote from Victor. Quote, "At times, it seems to me that the more we engage with and depend on technology, the less we engage and connect with clients." Now, is that the case? And if it is, where do we go from here to enable sellers to connect and have better and more productive sales conversations with their buyers? Well, stay tuned for all that and more. But before we get to Victor, I want to let you know that all of us who work to produce this podcast are incredibly grateful for all of you who support us by listening to the show, telling your friends, sharing it on social media, and most importantly, subscribing to this show and giving us your feedback in the form of a rating and a review. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Victor, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Andy. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. A pleasure to meet you somewhat virtually, but as we were just talking before the show, we had not had the opportunity to meet.
No, and as I mentioned at the pre-show is that I kept hearing your name. People were shocked that I didn't know who you were. So you're like some celebrity I didn't know about. And I felt like ashamed, like, who is this guy named Andy? I don't know. But anyway, so I'm here, finally.
Yeah. Very, as I tell my wife, I'm very famous in a very small circle. So it's great because I think we like have you here because I think I'm anxious to share thoughts on a number of topics that I think we are concerned about in common. And one that you've written about and you've talked about is this concern about declining sales performance. You know, we all see the same stats that come from the various industry reports, whether CSO Insights or whatever. And just interested what your thoughts are, is why that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I always talk about that sales will always be known as pre-internet and post-internet. You know, pre-internet, we had all the information as salespeople, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, customers were willing to talk to us a little longer. You can build a relationship, so forth and so on. Fast forward, we have this thing called the internet now. And Google came out with a study years ago. It's called the ZMOT study, Zero Moment of Truth study, right, which you're familiar with, right?
Right, yep.
And my favorite number in there is that, and I bet you that number has gone up, is that on average, people will look at 10 sources of information before deciding to reach out to contact the vendor, which means, again, depending on which numbers you read, the customer could be anywhere between 57 to 90% into the buying cycle, which means they're a little smarter these days. And I think that's what makes sales a little more challenging now, is that salespeople have to be more domain experts than ever before in order to provide that quote-unquote insight we often hear about.
Yeah, I don't really think I see much evidence of them becoming more domain experts, right? I mean, I you know, I do. The topic I want to get into is like, because this show, you know, so look back on all my past episodes, 755 or whatever, is that, you know, what we're really talking about is we're talking about how do we enable sellers, and this is what you spend your life doing as well, is how do we enable sellers to sell to the best of their abilities, right? Mm-hmm. And correct. Yet we seem to have this gap, right? We've got this declining performance because, you know, this is all occurring at the same time we're in this golden age of sales technology, that, you know, unprecedented levels of technology coming into sales, which, you know, some can be very beneficial for sellers. And yet we're seeing declining performance. It's so, I know there's not a connection between the
right?
two.
It's kind of like, well, we got more tools, we have more knowledge, we have more access, we have more abilities to reach out and touch somebody, whether it's video conferencing call, so forth and so on. But why are the numbers declining? And I still go back to that customers are more, you know, one of the biggest misconceptions or misperceptions is that salespeople are no longer needed as much because, you know, consumers have a lot of information. And I think that's the biggest error.
Absolutely.
I think salespeople are now more valuable than ever because there's so much information out there. There's so much content out there that now buyers are actually confused. And it takes a great salesperson, I go back to the domain expert piece, to actually help them clarify their thinking in order to make a decision. Because what are they trying to avoid, Andy? You know this. I'm preaching to the choir. They're trying to avoid making a bad decision. Because now, you know, some of these investments are kind of big, especially if it's a B2B type enterprise level sale. So people want to be careful in terms of how they invest. But all this uncertainty has created a greater dependence on salespeople. And I think where they fall short, and I want to emphasize, it was a stat that was put out by, are you familiar with Corporate Visions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And I was listening to a speech years ago, a couple of years ago, by Tim Reister, one of their researchers, great presenter. And he actually talked about, you know, that on average, across industry study, 40% of all deals are won. Again, cross industry, across different industries.
Are won, you said?
Are won. In other words, they won the deal.
Yeah.
Right? That means 60% are lost. What's interesting is when they looked at the 60% that were lost, 20% went to the competitor. Mm-hmm. The other 40% were no decisions.
Right.
So if you think about it, your biggest competitor is, as he quotes it, the status quo, the no decision.
Yeah, I've seen a study that shows that it's as high as 80%.
Could be, which begs the question. So why is there a no decision? And that's because it is the anxiety versus the certainty that the customer is experiencing. And if a salesperson isn't able to go in there and clarify that thinking, guide them, and reassure them, they're not going to make a decision. Buyer's regret is always looming around the corner. I'd rather not make a decision than make a decision and be wrong.
I think, yeah, well, risk is certainly a huge factor, right? That perception of risk on the part of the buyers. But I also think that part of that, too, is that, and this still, I guess, is a factor of the risk, but is that for sellers, they don't give the customer, help guide the customer to a point where there's a compelling reason for them to make a change, risk notwithstanding. And so what I see oftentimes with when customers who don't reach a decision and you do an analysis of the deal and the opportunity is you look back and say, well, yeah, we never really qualified them, right? We never got to the point where the customer said, yeah, these are the outcomes we want to achieve with this investment in your product or solution. And we know what that outcome is going to mean for us in terms of hard dollars. We've quantified what those outcomes are. And for me, that's like this critical point, right? If you haven't got your prospect to quantify what the outcome is going to mean to them in dollars, they're not going to close.
Correct. And there's two components in there. If you go further, your point is dead on. But push it just a little further.
Sure.
That even if I quantified the sale and I actually created a magnitude of that sale. Look, I mean, it's not just a little bit of improvement. It's a big improvement, mm-hmm. something that has some magnitude. There's also this, and I think this is where the brakes are being applied. There's this perceived effort / risk. And I'll give you a perfect example. When I talk about this in my talks, it's a stupid story, but true and really draws attention to what happens. About a year ago, I had a small little leak in my bathroom. I heard it from my office. I go, what is that? I heard this little tick, tick, tick. And I go, what is that? So I go over there to the sink and open up the bottom of the sink, open up the drawers, and all of a sudden I see this thing just dripping. You know, that whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at it and I go, now if you're a real man, what do you do? Well, if you're like me
call
and you're not mechanically inclined, you go to the kitchen, you get a bowl. And so I went to the kitchen and got a bowl. And I stuck the bowl under there and said, look, wife, it's fixed.
Right.
And so a couple of weeks go by, the droplets get faster and faster. So what do? You get a bigger bowl. So I went and got the bigger bowl, slid it right under there. Finally, you get to the point where you can't stick a bucket in there. Mm-hmm. You got to tell yourself, I got to fix this thing. And so sure enough, I mentally psyched myself up to go over to Home Depot to get all the supplies. The next day, I'm going to go in, Andy, I'm going to get this thing fixed. Man, I go in there, Andy, the next day after, you know, drank my coffee, go in, and it's like 5 minutes into this thing, bam, it is fixed. It is PVC'd up. It is fixed. And the first question that comes to mind is, well, why didn't I do that like 2-3 weeks ago?
Mm-hmm.
And what it was is that there was this imagined fear in my head, mm-hmm. because based on my past experiences, things had never gone well with plumbing.
Yeah.
This imagined fear is there. So that part of the brain, the primal brain, that amygdala was right. lighting up like a Roman candle. And what is the job of a salesperson? Because a customer is thinking the same thing, the perceived effort and the imagined fear. Our job in selling is to assuage the customer's concern that it's going to be okay. Here's the blueprint. Here's how we're going to do it in 5 easy steps. And that's where I think we fail, in assuaging the customer's concern that we're going to be able to do that for them.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating point, because again, as having a conversation with somebody else about this is, because now you're sort of talking about trust, right? Mm-hmm. And the question we were just debating was, really, how much trust does a buyer need to have in a seller in order to make the decision, right, to buy from mm-hmm. them? I use the analogy as, you know, I know my customer trusts me enough to buy from me, but they probably don't trust me enough to babysit their kids. So what is this level of trust that we really have? Is it really trust, or is it this, you know, because we're talking about the perception of risk, is it really the perception of trustworthiness that is really this attribute we're trying to develop in the mind of the buyer?
I think that what you just said is brilliant, because it's that perception of trust, right? And I was reading a book I interviewed about 2 weeks ago, Jonah Berger, mm-hmm. has a new book called The Catalyst.
He's coming on the show in a couple weeks. There,
yeah. Okay. He's a great guy. And in there, I told him, I said, you know, you're doing a great definition of trust, but I don't think you meant to do it. But I perceived it, because it was kind of one of those just statements in the book. Mm-hmm. It wasn't anything he was emphasizing. And his definition of trust, the way he defined it, lined it up in the book. I go, I like this one. The first one, it's a two-part trust factor. The first part is you empathize, you understand my pain. You really understand what I'm going through.
Mm-hmm.
And then, plus, you also have my best interest in mind.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you can put those two together, understand, and I know that you have my best interest in mind, then I trust you. You know, the problem is, there is no meter over somebody's head to say, hey, I think you've reached that point, or you've crossed that, you know, the threshold. Yeah, I trust you.
Right.
It'd be nice, but there isn't. But I think empathy and knowing you have their best interest in mind, being able to communicate that effectively, is the challenge.
Right. So there's a couple things you said there, I think, really critical for people to understand, at least my point of view. One is there are various forms of empathy, and, you know, compassionate empathy, which is the one that most people most often talk about. I feel, you know, how you feel, I understand. But you talk about understand, right? This is the thing where salespeople oftentimes don't do, is we don't. To me, true empathy comes from when I understand why somebody feels the way they do. If I have that understanding, as you talked about, then that's important. And then the second part you brought about is, yeah, do they think we have their best interest in mind? Is, are we completely transparent in our motivations for why we're talking to the buyer in the first place? And this is something that, you know, you've seen undoubtedly millions of times, like I have, is that, you know, we go in and we tell the customer, God, we're here to help you. We're here to serve you. We're here to serve you. And then we get to Thursday on the last week of the month, and it's like, but here's 10% or 20% off to make sure you buy this month.
Right.
And suddenly our motivations become very clear. It's no longer about serving them. It's about us.
Isn't that something? There's so many contradictions in what we do. And when you look at a lot of sales training programs out there, I'm often amazed at, you know, how I believe in the philosophy, slow down to speed up. We've all heard that, right? Mm-hmm. Slow down to speed up. In other words, really talk to the customer, really try to understand them. And I think one of the key things I think the best of the best do is they're not afraid to lose the sale.
Right.
By being forthright. Like, you know, and so I always talk about people don't have a sales problem. They have a prospecting problem. And that is that if you had enough prospects, you'd sell differently. But when you only have one or two prospects, you sell desperately. And said another way, if I have 100 customers lined up waiting to see me, I'm going to be like, all right, let's qualify hard.
Yep.
Those who can afford or need my product on this side. Those who can't, please move to that side and come back another time. You sell differently. And removing that, if salespeople were to sell that way with no fear of losing the customer and just being forthright and looking out for their best interest, empathizing, looking out for best interest, and just laying it down right down the middle, I think they'd be surprised how many people would just come towards them. You know what I mean? How many people would want to buy from them?
Yeah, well, I think the corollary to what you were saying is that, yeah, when you can teach people to be that way and to sell that way, is it very quickly highlights the fact that, wow, I need to go get more prospects, right? Because even if they don't have enough, when they find it and they can teach them to understand that's how they should be addressing and helping the customer, then they get that motivation to go out and get more prospects because, wow, I get this.
Yeah. Sometimes I think people don't truly understand the value of what they're really offering. Do you know what I mean? They don't understand the impact, the ripple effect of what their product or service can do for a company. For example, I sell sales training, right? That's one of my products. And so I believe when I sell it, I'm not looking at selling the package. I'm looking at how it's going to impact your bottom line, how it's going to increase your revenue, reduce your cost, or expand your market share. I'm looking at how I'm helping you not only stay in business, but keep people employed within your company. And those people in your company have families. So guess what? The fact that I'm helping you help your company, helps families, that's the way I view the value of it. So I don't mind rushing to somebody's help. Here, I can help you sell more. I can help you generate more revenue. Where sometimes I think people don't understand their real value. They just see the price, not the value.
Well, isn't some of that maybe tied to also is they don't see their own value in the context of what they're selling? I mean, I'm a huge believer that based on my own experience, as well as experience of many, many others I've worked with, is that, you know, people still buy from people. And, you know, if you're not a person of value, doesn't really matter what the product and service does. You'll lose the deal all the time if you're not a person of value, if you're selling a product that's high value. And people, we're still having a hard time convincing sellers that this is of paramount importance, more so than your sales process or anything else that you're doing.
Ethics above all else. You know, ethics above all else in terms of how you sell. And I think in a world where we've reached, I don't know, in the world of Six Sigma, where all products are almost the same, all services almost the same. There are no real differentiators unless you're an Apple or Google or somebody different. Every product or service is the same. And so I truly believe we've entered an era, Andy, where the salesperson, as you're pointing out, is the differentiator. And if they don't see their value in that process as part of that sales equation, if I may, then I think they're missing out because they are the differentiators today.
Yeah, and I think part of it is that increasingly we've told salespeople to focus on the wrong things. And part of this, I think, is part of the way that we increasingly are selling through our inside sales and sales specialization and so on. And sort of, fixation on activity versus, quantity of activities versus quality of activities and so on. But Gartner, I don't know if you remember, they did their buyer enablement study a couple years ago and they came out with this, what they call their spaghetti diagram, this complex flow chart of a buyer's process.
And
what they highlight is that the buyers don't have this sort of linear stage-based process to go through to buy. They have four jobs they need to complete, and they don't necessarily happen in series. And there's problem identification, solution exploration, building requirements, choosing a vendor. And increasingly, my belief is that we train sellers to only focus on the last one, choosing a vendor. Which is, the horses out of the barn at that point, because what we want to do is focus on those first three, because that's how we influence how they're going to solve their problem. And if we can influence how they solve their problem, then when they get to choosing who they're going to solve it with, we have the inside track. But instead, when we just focus on being competing at selecting the vendor stage, then we compete on price.
Every time. It's the bake-off at the end.
Right.
And I think what's, you know, back to the original question, why are the numbers so low? Why do they keep declining in terms of close rates and winnings? Also think about, you know, Andy, the number of people involved in the decision-making process today. Mm-hmm. That number continues to increase, which now, you know, if you remember back in the day, what was the book? I think it was Strategic Selling, the Miller-Holloman, where you can find the management buyer, the user buyer, the technical buyer. Economic buyer, you know. And so you have those four types of buyers. But today, and then you find their motivations and their why buys, and you address those motivation, those dominant buying motives, and then you sell to those dominant. Well, the thing is, now you got 10 people in the room, 11 people in the room, you know, and all of a sudden it becomes quite complex. Add to that what you just said, that it's never a linear process, you know, A, B, C, identification, you know, assess what's going on, what needs to be done, and then begin to narrow down, do the search, find vendors, now bring them in, qualify them, let's have a bake-up, let's talk about it. It's never that clean. And so I think from a B2B perspective, it's become so complicated that a lot of buyers are actually doing the research on their own. And this is where it gets really interesting, because now, unless you're an aggressive salesperson, by aggressive, I mean very active in reaching out to customers to try to insert yourself early on into the buying cycle. By that, I mean when the problem is still being identified,
you're not going to
close the deal. You're at the mercy at the end of the buyer at the end asking for a discount or some type of, you know.
Yeah, well, not this
giveaway.
Right, and I learned this through my own experience. Sold big, large, complex satellite communication systems for a long time. And I just remember early in my career, I was working on one of my first deals with that. And I remember calling my boss after I was overseas in Europe. And I remember calling my boss and said, yeah, we're going to win this deal. Mm-hmm. And it was 6 months before I got the order. And we won it, right? Because I knew at that point that going forward, they were going to base their requirements on our product and our services.
If you can get your product spec'd in early on,
that's right, man.
And hey, by the way, I don't know if I told you this, Andy. I don't know if you knew this, but I came from the telecom side.
No, I didn't.
I did. I started out as an electrical engineer, got an MBA, and I started actually designing wireless systems and then moved into fiber optics and hybrid fiber, coax, all those wonderful things, and actually sold some satellite equipment, some transponder, transceivers, all that good stuff. So I'd know about getting your product spec'd in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you came from the technical side as a history major, but it was, it opened my eyes at that point to say, this is what I'm trying to do, right? If I can influence the choice they're making about how they want to solve their problem, then the decision about who they want to solve it with becomes much simpler, and I've got the advantage going into it. It'll still be competitive, but I have the advantage because it's designed around, you know, my ideas and our product, our service, and so on.
You know this for a fact already, that if you can co-create the solution with the customer, you're going to win that deal. I used to tell people every time I got the technical person up with me on the whiteboard.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would win the deal. You know, or let's just say the probability was very high I would get the deal because now we were co-creating their solution.
Yeah, did you ever read Dan Rome's book, Draw to Win?
No, I never even heard of the book. Draw to Win.
Draw to Win by Dan Rome, R-O-A-M. And he's been a guest on the show, and he's a very smart guy. And he's written several books about drawing and business and so on. But this Draw to Win, he gives that precise examples. You know, you may know what your flow chart's going to look like, but don't draw at all. Stop. Invite the customer up.
Every time.
Can you help me finish this? Right? Just as you said, that becomes so powerful.
Yeah. Or just, I always hold the marker out. I said, I'm not understanding something. Can you draw this out for me? How the network you want to configure. And they're like, sure. And I'm like, here we go. And so subtle things, the more you can co-create. In fact, I just finished reading a book called The Expansive Sale.
No, I don't know that
one. It's got several authors on that. Corporate Visions, guys.
Okay.
And in there, they talked about how, you know, using, they looked at using PowerPoint versus using big pictures with big words on them on the PowerPoint slides versus bullet points. And then the third one was actually drawing.
Right.
And obviously, when you drew, you know, the credibility went up. Mm-hmm. Engagement went up, so forth and so on. So the numbers are there. that being able to draw things also shows that you have some type of, if I can go back to the phrase, some domain expertise, that you can draw things out. And I'll give you a perfect example of where I think domain expertise fails. I was looking for a drone, and they just wanted to buy a drone, man.
Take photos.
Yeah. To make a long story short, I budgeted $1,200 for this drone, and I've been doing all my research. You know, I went beyond the Google 10 sources. I just started searching, right? I narrowed it down to about three choices. I go over to Best Buy, and I'm looking at the displays. There they are, the three drones, right? And I'm thinking, okay, one of these three, I'm going home with one of these bad boys. My credit card is ready to leap out of my pocket. I am ready to buy, Andy. You see what I'm at? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, this guy comes over. He's like 6'7", 6'8", big giant dude. He says, can I help you? I said, yeah, I'm thinking of buying one of these drones. But let me just kind of, you know, read what's in front of me. And then if I need your help, I'll call you. He says, I'll be right over there if you need me. I said, great. So sure enough, I narrowed it down to two drones. Size became a factor, one of the new variables. I said, you know what? Let's look at size. Let's go with the smaller ones. So sure enough, I call the guy over. I'm ready. Tell me the difference between these two drones. I'm ready to make a decision. And he starts reading, I swear to you, he starts reading the little
tag on the shelf.
Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, I can see that. I can read. I said, but beyond that, why is one better than the other? What would you say? What is your opinion as an expert? He goes, well, and he mumbled a couple of things. I go, wait a minute, do you even have a drone? He goes, no, I don't. I said, were you trained on the drones? He goes, no, I wasn't. And then it was a very awkward moment. Like, you are no use to me here. Mm-hmm. And so my level of certainty was very low. So I walked out of the store, credit card still in check, $1,200, just walked out the door.
Did you buy it online?
That to me epitomized what's going on today.
Did you end up buying it online?
I ended up buying it online. Yeah. Yes, I did. You know what I did? I did the whole spindle effect. I went on Amazon, looked at the reviews, read tons of reviews, and eventually came to my own conclusion.
Right.
Because I couldn't find a salesperson to help me. It was too frustrating.
Yeah, and undoubtedly that we have cases of that in B2B world, but most, to your point earlier, is anything with any sort of complexity, it's not transactional, it's the buyers, because of the risk that you and I spoke about before, they want the salesperson there to help them, help them make a purchase decision. I think fundamentally that is a salesperson's job if they really think about it. It's and I've written about this in my book, is your job is to help a buyer make a purchase decision. That's it.
That's it. I think CEB came out with an interesting study, and I'm going to see if I can recite off the top of my head. CEB, which is now Gartner, obviously.
Gartner, right, yeah.
And I think this study was in, do you remember the book, The Challenger Sale, which came out in, I think, December of 2011, something like that. And in there, they had this slide, off the top of my head, I think it was about customer loyalty, what drivers of customer loyalty. And I think it was 19% was brand loyalty, which shocked me. 19% was brand loyalty. 9% was service to price ratio, in other words, pricing. 19% was service and delivery, right? But the big one, the difference, 50%+ was the buying experience.
Yep.
And then they go ahead and define the buying experience, help me navigate, make alternatives, avoid making wrong decisions, so forth and so on, make it easy to buy, blah, blah, blah. And it just brought me back. When I saw that slide, I go, wow, brand is no longer the dominant factor for buying. It's a consideration. But the buying experience overall is what people are missing. And I think when that guy couldn't help me, he ruined my buying experience.
Right. And one of the key things you just spoke about is people formulating their choices. And so there's been a bunch of studying done on how people make decisions. And, you know, this one author, it's a guy named Paul Nutt, who was at Ohio State University, has written about this, is he's saying that people make decisions, they go through two steps. First one is I'm going to choose how I want to solve the problem or whether I am going to solve the problem. And then the second part is, okay, who am I going to solve it with? And so when people go to do that first one, how they're going to solve it, that's when they look at their options. What are my options? Mm-hmm. Well, if you can't help them, if you can't be one of those options, if you can't give them enough information to be one of the options, you're never going to get the second decision. So yeah, this is where the credibility comes in. This is where, I mean, a lot of things that you talk about in your SMART framework, which I really liked, which I want to talk about for a second, is if people can be enabled to perform in those situations, to understand what their real job is, and it's not, at that point, it's not to get the order, it's to help the customer make the right choice about how they're going to solve their problem, then you're more likely to get the order.
Every time. Again, I think it, you know, we can say the word empathize 100 times. I mean, but that's the core. Do you really understand what I'm trying to achieve?
Yeah.
Every person is asking, you know, that's the ultimate question, isn't it? If you understand what I'm trying to achieve, then I know you get me. Yeah. I know you understand me.
Right.
But yeah, too often we go into transactional mode though, Andy. You know what I mean? We got to get the sale. We want to get the sale. Get the sale. Close that deal.
Well, I think that one of the things that we don't stress enough with sellers, or it doesn't stress at all, is that, you know, we always talk about creating value for the buyer. Understanding them is huge value for the buyer. To your point, if we really understand, if we do the right discovery, if we make sure we confirm our understanding, we ask the right follow-up questions, we ask confirmation questions, mirroring questions, all those things, mm-hmm. understanding, and to their point, your point is, they really get me, right? They get it. Mm-hmm. That's huge. That's huge value for the buyer. That deals with the risk. It deals with all these other things we've spoken about today.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by the irony that during the day, you're a salesperson, but at the end of the day, you're a consumer. And if you ask somebody, how do you like to be sold? Because people say, well, how do I sell effectively? And ask yourself, how do you like to be sold? And the way you like to be sold is how you should sell, but it's not. It's usually mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And you ask a lot of people, how do you want to be sold? Well, I want a buyer to be informed, or seller to be informed. I want them to be direct, to be honest. And, you know, again, not look out for their interest, look out for mine. Great. Boom. There's your instructions. Go sell now.
Oh, it escapes a lot of people. I tell the story in my books about the CEO. This is a number of years ago, but he had a CEO client, and he was just bitching at me, not about me, but he had just been trying to reach some company I couldn't remember which one, on their phones, and he got stuck in sort of this phone tree. And he's like, it's the worst customer service. This, you know, how do they sell anything? Da, 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 slams the phone down. So I pick up my cell phone. I dial a number. I hand it to him. It's his company. Does the exact same thing. And their sales voicemail box was full. And no one was ever paying attention to it, answering it. And it finally sunk in with him. I was like, oh, yeah, I see. I see the thing here. So, I should want to be sold.
It's always interesting that we can see the error in other people's ways, but our own.
Yeah. That's why it works out. So I did want to spend a few minutes on the SMART framework you have for sellers, because I think it's not just a way to assess sellers. I think it's a way to really enable sellers, right? If you look at, so SMART is an acronym for skills, motivation, adaptability, resources, and time. And so tell us a little bit how you came up with that.
Well, I was looking at, you know, what is it that a salesperson needs in today's market? And it's more, I guess when I came up with the SMART framework, it's more of a holistic approach to what you need to do to be a great salesperson. So, you know, we know that it's always about skill and will. We've all heard that phrase, right? Skill, and then there's will, right? A lot of people have skill, but they don't have the will. And the will part is actually very interesting, because I think you can develop a lot of skill. But the will piece is, what do you have to do consistently on a day-to-day basis to actually be successful? And I think that, if you were to ask me, what is the one thing, you mentioned it earlier, you briefly said it, but I picked up on it because you understand it, that a lot of times we measure activities, right? Mm-hmm. But also, you know, beyond activities, we look for high leverage activities. But then beyond high leverage activities, it's consistently doing those high leverage activities to make you successful. So the SMART model or framework was just a way for people to understand, these are the different skill sets, because we're just an aggregation of different skill sets that come into play.
Well, I want to dissect it just a little bit. I mean, because first of all, you start with skills. And this is, now you say you sell sales training, but, you know, there's the sales training of the way we currently do it doesn't really work. I mean, it's always a question I have, and I'm not, no offense on yours. It's just like, we study CEOs, say they don't find any value in sales training. We know that we've known for 150 years that, you know, people forget 90% of what they learn in a classroom setting within 30 days, all that stuff. We're really approaching skill development the right way. And combining with that, the reluctance of many sales managers, frontline sales managers, to get involved in sort of the personal development side of their reps to help them. Is there a better way?
There, you know, the best way to learn is obviously, you know, without practicing in front of your client, without practicing on the client, is, you know, role playing. That to me has been the biggest help in my career. being able to sit down and say, let us talk, let's have a simulated discussion. Because I think what happens when we look at skill sets, there, let's kind of really, let's go ahead and slice that one up a little bit.
Sure.
Right? Skill are the, you know, because you can look at the mechanics of actually presenting and selling, right? And so we can talk about the soft skills. And the soft skills are, you know, your body language, you know, your presence, you know, all the wonderful things. Listen carefully, you know, two ears, one mouth, use them in that proportion type of thing, right? Those are the soft skills. And, but when we look at soft skills, then we have to say, what are the, I'll call these the response skills. Is that the response skills is, you just asked me a question. How do I respond? And I think there's a skill set in that. There's a skill in, how do I respond to a question that was just asked? Do I just answer it? Or do I clarify then ask? And I think you need to develop that. That isn't something that's automatic. That's something that you
the
have to develop.
The clarify and ask part, yeah.
What's that?
To clarify first, then ask a follow-up question or
that's
to
correct.
Respond.
Right? Too often we're like, just want to jump in. And so that's a skill, right? Listen, absorb, reflect, and then deliver something. And if you have to clarify, go ahead and do that. And unless you practice that as a skill, you don't develop that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll move over to, you know that was it Albert Mehrabian? You know that phrase on the study on liking. 55% of whether I like you or not is visual. 38% is based on my voice, my tone, and only 7% is actual content or verbiage, right? And the one that always stuck out to me was the 38% of whether I like you or not is based on tone, voice, speed, alignment, right? And so there's another skill set. And you have to be very conscious of this.
Right.
And it can be learned that when you go down, look, when I'm in Florida, I talk real fast. When I moved to Georgia, things begin to slow down. So did I, right? You know what I mean? So these are things that you have to learn. These are skills that you can learn. Whether it's, you know, we can talk about mirroring and all those wonderful things, but at the end of the day, are you conscious? It's almost like being mindful of what you're doing
Absolutely.
In the moment when you're selling. And that is a skill that has to be learned, but can only be learned through, I guess, feedback, reflection, and it takes time. And that's why I say selling is a skill, just like speaking in public is a skill.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way, you and I both know that I can say something one way and just flip a couple of words and it has a totally different impact.
Right.
And the ability to, you know, and I don't know if I'm answering your question, but to me, when I use the word skill, I mean all of it.
Right.
You know, not just learn, hey, walk in, say hi, shake his hand, you know, ask a couple of questions. You know, that's the mechanical stuff. It's the stuff in between, the soft stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of look at a hierarchy of behaviors, practice consistently become habits, practice consistently become skills. And because, you know, it's never going to be a skill if you don't practice it, right?
That's correct.
but I think that we tend to want to diminish the importance of a lot of the soft skills these days just because, you know, people feeling so pressured to, you know, do a certain quantity of activities and so on. And it's like, okay, well, how do we train people to slow down? Because this is to your point, is so right. Is selling has to be a deliberate act. If you're just scripted and you're just reading off the script and you're just trying to follow the playbook and you're not putting any thought into it, you're not going to get anywhere, right?
Yeah, it's hard to find mental space.
You have to be in the moment. Yeah.
It's hard to find, you know, the thing is, as you're pointing out, you know, you're under a lot of pressure to hit those numbers, make those dials, get those meetings set up, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so all of a sudden, that's what you're being measured on. This morning, I was writing up a podcast when I was talking about measuring the wrong KPIs.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you measure the wrong KPIs, you get the wrong results. And also, salespeople are not stupid. They know how to game the system.
Sure.
If you're going to measure me on the number of calls, well, hell, I'll just call anybody. If you're going to measure me on new client acquisition, well, hell, I'll just get a bunch of clients. I don't care about the quality. And so, you know, sometimes we're focusing on the wrong things, those activities, because we believe they're tangible, they're metrics, let's measure those. But the unintended consequences are always there, as you well know.
Well, so I'll ask you an interesting question, or I think it's an interesting question. Is my show, I can ask it. Is to that point, is quota an outdated metric?
That's a really good question. That's a really good question. I would say no, because I believe that there has to be some type of aspirational goal to go after, right? But I would also allow some, I'll call this a ventilating modifier, to let it ventilate a little bit. In other words, allow for other options. And that is, we could argue that I'm more concerned, and again, did another podcast on this, where sometimes we're so short-term that we're not looking at the customer lifetime value.
Okay.
So then I would argue that maybe quota isn't important, and maybe customer lifetime value is a bigger metric to look at. For example, in my new book, I have a new book coming out. It's called Upselling is the New Prospecting.
Mm-hmm.
Upselling to your existing customers.
Right.
And so in there, I highlight how Starbucks has a 20-year lifetime value. So they're not looking at the immediate number, so mm-hmm. to speak. They're looking at 20 years worth of possibilities here.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, I think indirectly you're asking me, Victor, is it, are we looking at now numbers every year, or are we really looking at the business as we move forward? That's why I think there's an argument to be made that on one hand, quotas are important, but is customer lifetime value more important over the long run?
Right.
And we could have another debate on that. But I think both are valid depending on the industry and the business.
Yeah, I'd have you think about, we could talk about this another time because we're running out of time here.
By the way, it's a great question, though. It's a great question, though, because you're challenging one of the, you know,
central
one of the
tenets of selling. Yes,
you are. You're basically saying, "Ha, it's almost like a very socialist idea." If I might throw in that, because
I think it's the opposite, right? I think that I think that quota has become sort of this central plan, and mm-hmm. that suppresses performance and overall performance and measured in terms of dollars sold. So just to give you an example, a couple points. One is, you know, it's a British economist, Charles Goodhart, who formulated this law called Goodhart's Law. And he did this in the 60s, and there's been studies on it that have proven it out, which Goodhart's Law says, in short, that when a measure becomes a target, it loses all value as a measure.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because what you do is you optimize your process to achieve the target.
Yeah.
And
as they say, when the metric is the mission is no longer valid.
Same thing, right? Just said a different way. And so
yeah.
What becomes self-fulfilling prophecy, right? If we have our central, you know, five-year plan, you know, Soviet style, and say, hey, this is what quota is going to be, we know on balance people aren't going to exceed it because that's what they're aiming at. Instead of saying, what if we had my favorite example, this is, what if we measured true productivity for sellers? So your productivity, you have a productivity factor. You know, you sell X number of dollars of revenue per hour of selling time.
Mm-hmm.
If I compensated you on you improving the number of dollars per hour of sales time mm-hmm. that you generated, there's no limit to what you'd do.
Right, right. So, you know, you've seen the sales velocity equation, right? Take the number of opportunities, multiplied by the close rate, multiplied by the average deal size, divided by the sales cycle. That's how fast you're selling, mm-hmm. right? And that's a metric you could use. If you could increase your sales velocity, then that's another way of measuring that. So I do like that. I love the question about challenging a quota. I'm with you on that. I'm going to really think about that tonight. Going, you know, what would replace it? What would make more sense? A great question, Andy.
Well, also just one last point too is to think about is, you know, what if sales cycles really aren't a duration of time, but they're a quantity of time.
They're what?
They're a quantity of time. Your sales cycle is really not 3 months long. It's how many hours did you spend in those 3 months
working
engaged
on
with the buyer?
That. Great point, actually. Great point. Because you're right. If we don't measure it by, in other words, we switch how we measure it.
Yeah.
As opposed to days.
Because the duration.
I've never heard that.
The duration is an
heard
artifact.
Anybody talk,
what's right? that? The duration of time is an artifact. Yeah, it could
right.
be. It could be yeah. 6 months because the customer needs 6 months to go through it. But how much time did we have to invest during
right.
those 6 months?
Right. Yeah. So in other words, it's interesting because it's a great match. It's really good. That's a mind bender right there in a good way. That from a seller standpoint, from the person buying, they have a sales cycle, how long it took. But really, we should look at our duration and investment of time. Because from there,
yeah,
because in there, we can also extract opportunity costs in case we're working on the wrong thing.
And how effective we were and the interactions we had with the buyer and all that.
Yeah.
So,
by the way, to your point on the quotas and making unrealistic quotas, you and I came from a space where people would give us quotas willy-nilly.
Yeah.
You know, just, you know, they just kind of came up with it. They had a top number and then they distribute to quotas. Exactly. That's how it used to work. And I think the downside of that, well, there were many downsides, but one big downside was that if the salesperson didn't believe they could do it, there was no line of sight, so to speak, mm-hmm. using a technology term, there that they would actually feel defeated and give up and maybe even quit.
Right.
And so churn rates and quota, you know, unrealistic quotas and churn rate, it'd be interesting to see what the correlation between those two are.
It'd be interesting. I bet you there is, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I think quotas are still, by and large, arbitrarily set.
I would agree with you. Because every time I ask them, how'd you come up with that number? Well, you know, we took this, we took the average of that, and
divided by 10, took away 20%, and there we go. Yeah. And they're wondering why they're not hitting their targets. So.
And so it's this irrational exuberance to keep growing, almost as if quotas are anti-gravity. They should never go down. They should always go up.
Well, I had this conversation with CEOs at a... I was presenting to a group of CEOs at a private equity firm, you know, meeting their portfolio CEOs. And mm-hmm. I said, well, so raise your hand if you're going to raise quota next year. And everybody raises their hands. I said, great. Said, you know, it's like 10%, you know, 15%. We sort of did a rough average. I said, great. So have you trained your salespeople to be 15% better this year?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's just like, what? Oh, you mean there's a correlation between raising quota and making our people better? Oh,
yeah.
No. So
That's interesting.
Lots of good questions.
I've used that before, and it's like, yeah, they're like, what did you just say to me? And I'm like, yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
And the answer is no, obviously. They hadn't thought about it. They just said, go get us more money.
Right. Yeah. And no attention given to, well, let's improve the asset that's going to generate that extra revenue. So... Victor, I've got to take off, but that's been fascinating. Love our conversation. We'll have to make sure we do it again.
Yeah, we come from the same space and background, so yeah, we'll have to do part two again. We got to finish the framework eventually.
Yeah, well, that's true. We only got through the S of the smart, so we'll definitely come back because I really enjoy that. I think that those are the five key things because skills, motivation, adaptability. Adaptability is huge. Yeah, we sort of touched on it several times here today, but adaptability is huge. Especially if, you know, because again, people are so scripted these days that when they hit a moment where they need to be adaptable, they don't know how to.
That's correct.
So, all right, we'll talk about that. Victor, it's been great talking to you, and we'll be talking again soon.
Thank you, Eddie. Appreciate it.
Okay, folks, thanks for listening. We're so grateful for your support for the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating. You can do that all on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this podcast is over. Me and my team would really appreciate it. So thank you so much. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.